Thank you very much for these very nice words. And I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to present it here. Is there a pointer or something?
Yes.
It's the best. Okay, so I would like to talk about quantum impurities out of equilibrium, work which was done with Pankaj Mehta, who is now a postdoc at Princeton. Quantum impurity out of equilibrium experimentally is described here. You see here a quantum dot between two leads, and the quantum dot is coupled to them via tunneling. Electrons from here can hop on and off. And the two leads are put at two different chemical potentials. And as such, there will be a current flowing between one lead across the dot, which develops strong correlations, to the other lead. And the question is how to describe such a setup. This is taken from David Goldhaber Gordon, sort of 98. And there are a lot of measurements, for example, of the current versus the voltage, or as a dependence on the temperature. But now what we want to do is to develop some theory for that. So here is the outline of the talk. The first part will be a general discussion how to pose the question, how to describe non-equilibrium. And the main message that I want to take from the first part is that to have steady state, which is the subject of our interest, one must work in an open system. Open system means on the infinite line to begin with. One cannot start from periodic boundary condition and take the limit afterwards. One has to work on the infinite line to begin with so as to have an influx and an outflux, which is inherent in the description of non-equilibrium. So what we are going to see is that to describe non-equilibrium dynamics, what we have to do is to construct scattering eigenstates. And the scattering eigenstates capture the physics of steady state, non-equilibrium. The second part will be how to construct those scattering eigenstates, and I will show how to construct them in a non-perturbative way by means of a Bethe ansatz. What I want to show is the traditional Bethe ansatz, which is described, which has been developed over the decades. Technologically was developed for a closed system with periodic boundary condition, and as such was inapplicable to the physics that we want to describe. We needed to develop a new formalism, and which are referred to as the scattering Bethe ansatz, which is designed to work on open system. And then I will apply it to the resonance level model. I'll describe how it works there. I will describe work in progress for the Kondo model. And once I've done that, I will show how to calculate quantities which describe non-equilibrium, like non-equilibrium currents, dissipation, entropy production. And then I'll end up with a laundry list of questions still to do. Okay, so this is advertisement. Non-equilibrium systems are poorly understood. We don't have a grand unifying principle as the Boltzmann principle, calculate the free energy e to the minus beta h, from which you can calculate afterwards all the thermodynamic quantities. So how to describe non-equilibrium is within by itself still unclear. And also many of the methods that we use to describe statistical mechanics or things in equilibrium are not applicable. Scaling doesn't work. Scaling usually requires us to go to a regime where where we know how the scales scale, but here we have a current flowing through the system, which doesn't allow us to go close to the ground state, which keeps us very highly excited. So the usual RG doesn't work. Question, does universality work? All kind of new questions open.
But none of this is specific to the system you're thinking of, because I know plenty of systems where you can do this. Out of equilibrium.
There are a lot of different systems. They are all different. So for some it may work, for some it may not work. There is no unifying principle. So what we need to understand is case by case. And in particularly in the system that I'm interested, which are strongly correlated, this does not work. So what we are interested in quantum impurities where this interplay between non-equilibrium and strong correlation is particularly simple. We have a lot of experiment and a lot of theoretical tools to describe it. So here is the actual physical system as realized in a lab. Typically, over that one can give a full lecture, so I will just summarize it in 2 minutes. Here you see the two leads. Here is the quantum dot. There is a gate voltage which can control the number of electrons on the lead. Here you see the scheme of the level structure. And on the upper level, I can have one or two one or two electrons. And here you see what happens if you have an odd number of electrons. You see the development of the Kondo effect. As you lower the temperature, the conductivity rises up to the unitarity limit. That is when a spin is present. And here, when the number of electrons is even, there is no spin, there is no Kondo effect. So if the level is not matching the chemical potential, there is no conductivity. So these were very early experiments on conductivity across quantum dot, but they were done typically when the levels were, when the chemical potentials were very close. Later on, they really had finite source-drain chemical potential difference, and much more interesting curves came out.
What do you say
A quantum dot is a tiny island isolated from... So what you do is you take a two-dimensional sheet of electrons, which is captured between gallium and gallium arsenide. So imagine you have a two-dimensional sheet of electrons. And on top of it, you put... electrodes, and they push electrons out and can isolate here a tiny island. So an electron hopping on this island has a very high charging energy of the order q square over 2c, where c is tiny. So this is very large, so it impedes another electron of hopping on. So typically you have, imagine you have just one electron sitting there. So electrons can hop on and off, but individually. So now what we are locking is one electron sitting there and electrons hopping on and off virtually to the leads. So in other words, it's a physical realization of a spin, a cup. So imagine here you have a spin sitting or general quantum impurity coupled to two leads, and the electrons can hop on and off from the leads to the impurity and back on. And the question is then how to compute currents, let's say, running from one impurity to the other. So a typical Hamiltonian consists of the two leads, free Fermi Cs, an impurity Hamiltonian, and the coupling between them. So the Kondo model, which was written down for this, or the Anderson model, are typical examples. So here are the two Fermi Cs. We can have, of course, more Cs, but I'll talk about two here. And here is the spin of the impurity, and here is the spin density of an electron hopping on and off. So the Hamiltonian that I've written down here is written out in three dimensions in full generality. I'll do now very standard operation to cast the physics of the dot into a one-dimensional formulation. So what one does is, here is the dot again, here is the Fermi C, here is the Fermi C. I assume the dot is spherically symmetric. I do a expansion in spherical waves. So instead of EIKA, I will get right and left moving with respect to the impurity.
I don't think that's quite working because the leads are not spherically symmetric, but I guess
if they are large enough, it's a good approximation.
The statement is that only the electron density near the dot
matters.
Actually interact with the dot and the hopping, and so this is a particular wave function
right.
Amplitude.
Right. It comes out from the fact that J is K independent, basically.
Yeah.
And once J is K independent, this is a spherical symmetric combination.
It's not the spherical symmetry that matters. It matters that only
coupling
at one point.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The one point coupled.
Right. This is a way of writing psi at the point zero. Thank you. Okay. So the second, I have in and out coming, and I will do a trivial operation which is called unfolding. I take the red and attach it here. So now I have only, instead of having electrons living in the half space, they live in the full space, but now they are chiral. And similarly for two, I have a chiral electrons moving in. So this is an exact representation of the dot problem. I will furthermore linearize the spectrum because I'm interested in the physics of low energy, because I'm interested in universal results that do not depend on the details of the density of states, and therefore I get a linear spectrum which captures the universal features of the system, and I can describe it in terms of a field theory. So the Hamiltonian that I'm interested here is given by some of the free bath, which are electrons moving here, or if you want to look at this picture here, and I have the density of lead 1 and lead 2 at 0 at spin density coupled to the impurity. So that's the system I'm interested in. Any questions? So sigma is a spin half, and S is also a spin half operator. Both of them are spin half. I didn't write out explicitly the spin component. So there would be here A, A, B, B. Okay, so given this is the Hamiltonian that describes the system, now I want to discuss how one sets up the non-equilibrium formulation. So this goes back to Keldysh in the 50s. And so imagine that the system before time t naught is some switch on time, is described by rho naught, some initial density operator. So at t naught, I couple the leads to the impurity, and then subsequently, sorry about that. Should be the other way around. For T, after T naught, the system is going to evolve with a Hamiltonian H naught of the leads plus e to the eta T H1, where H1 is the coupling of the leads to the dot. So if I'm talking about T positive at finite temperature, I have the following elements. I have an initial condition, and then I have an evolution operator that takes me from T naught, that evolves the system from T naught to T. So with these two elements, I can compute the evolved density operator, and with it, I can calculate the non-equilibrium expectation value of any operator I want. The same, of course, occurs at T equals to zero, in which case I will have only a state which gives me the initial condition. I evolve the state from phi naught at T naught to psi of T at any time later, and I will calculate expectation value. So what is, for example, a state phi naught? A typical at T equals to zero, I will choose the ground state in the presence of the chemical potential, lead one filled up to mu one, lead two filled up to mu two, so that's bath one times bath two, and the impurity is in some state but decoupled from the system. And yes?
What is the form of the time dependence? You have an exponential eta
t. E eta t. Eta is a small constant, which I'm going to take subsequently to zero. So this is an adiabatic turn on of the interaction. Okay. So as t goes to minus infinity, this disappears. So So the question that I want to address now is, when will a steady state occur? In other words, I described how I turn on the coupling, and a priori, there is no guarantee that a steady state occurs. There could be oscillation, there could be various transients. Experimentally, we know that when this operation is carried out in the lab, steady state occurs very fast. But the question is our Hamiltonian, the one I've written down, sufficiently rich to contain all the dissipation mechanisms required to reach steady state? Dissipation, I mean the following. You see, I have electrons hopping from the right to the left. So I have high energy electrons, which now are out of equilibrium with respect to the original system. And typically, those require some mechanism like phonons to dissipate their energy and fall down and reach an equilibrium situation. What I will now claim, and that's a theorem that we proved with Benjamin Doyon, is that if I take the limit of the system size L to infinity first, then a steady state will emerge. And what we have shown is that if we take indeed the limit L goes to infinity first, then the limit T naught to minus infinity exists. In other words, this limit is a very non-trivial limit because a lot of infrared divergences can occur, which signal that the system does not reach a steady state and it doesn't have enough dissipation mechanisms in it. So what is the dissipation mechanism introduced by the infinite volume limit? It's very simple. We allow the electrons just to escape to infinity. An electron that has scattered once disappears and doesn't scatter again. And this suffices to lead to a steady state. So we can see here the following picture. Imagine that I turn on the coupling at T equals to zero. There is some current that starts flowing. It can decay. There is some transitory. Then there is some plateau of the size of the system, which eventually will decay if the system is finite size because the chemical potentials will equalize. However, if I take the size of the system to infinity, this part will, of course, be pushed to minus infinity, but I can also push T naught to minus infinity, and therefore the dependence on T disappears. Size of the leads, yes.
Can I ask to understand exactly what that result means? I mean, you could imagine that a finite bias in some suitable system, you've got oscillatory behavior in time.
Yeah.
But maybe that would show up in two-time correlation functions.
No.
The origin of the...
I mean, you can imagine oscillatory, but in different systems. But here, when I have a steady state, I will have translational invariance.
Yeah.
So in a two-time correlation function, it will not be oscillatory again.
Well, it could be oscillatory in the separation. That's what I mean.
In the separation? No. If it is, I don't see that, because the system is translationally invariant in time.
Yeah, that's why it's saying...
So it depends on it depends on T1 minus T2, but not... oscillatory in this sense. Ah, you just mean a non-trivial dependence on T1 and T2. Yeah.
Rather than just...
Oh, yeah. No, that's obvious. That doesn't contradict it.
Right. So
that does not mean that there is no steady state. Steady state means that the current, let's say, will be time independent. You can have a situation where the current would oscillate in a Josephson junction.
But I mean, the way that you're turning things on, it's a bit like average. I mean, if you had oscillatory behavior, but you average over the origin in time, then you're going to get a result which is time independent.
I don't average.
Steady state by this definition.
I don't average. I just take limit T naught goes to infinity, and I should. Which is not
physically, your smooth turning on is a bit like averaging.
In a sense.
So
as long as I'm not interested in the transients, that's what I have to do.
Okay, and then just briefly, the other question in connection with that was, so the theorem you proved, how general a Hamiltonian is it?
This is
for the impurity.
For the impurity. Well, we strictly speaking, we've proven it for the condo model. But you can see how the proof would work, and the main element is that in the leads, the states form a continuum. There are no gaps. Okay. Now, if there are gaps, could be different story. But we didn't go through the detailed proof in other models. But you can see how it works very. The proof is not trivial. I mean, typically, what you have to do is Keldysh perturbation theory. So you go to order n, you get enormous amount of diagrams. With Benjamin, we reformulated the Keldysh perturbation theory so that each order has just one integral, a very difficult integral to evaluate, but it's one integral, and then we can show that the limit exists when t naught goes to minus infinity.
I understand your procedure. You switch along with an exponential function, but e to the
eta t, where t is negative.
What do you do when you go beyond, say, t equals zero, and you blow up?
No, I take eta to zero. So that is the order of limits. I first take l to infinity, t naught to minus infinity, and then eta to zero.
So you're looking at orders of five times.
So I'm looking at any fixed...
Well, compared to 1 over eta.
Yeah, 1 over eta goes to infinity. So for any fixed time, which I call 0 for convenience, I reach a Hamiltonian. So whenever you look at any fixed time, you have already full strength. So this limits in this order, and it's very important to have this order. So that means an open system, then you take T naught goes to minus infinity, then eta to zero. So this implies a steady state, and the expectation value becomes time independent. So what I claim is that the state psi s, which evolves out of phi naught, so that this state exists which evolves out of phi naught from minus infinity to time zero. I'll call this state psi of zero, and it exists. And it fully describes the non-equilibrium steady state physics. Okay? So when I come to this point, usually people jump on me and say, how can you describe non-equilibrium with a state? Okay? How can a stationary state, for example, how does a stationary state describe non-equilibrium? Because there are a lot of things we are associating with non-equilibrium. Entropy production, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, we are saying that I have a steady state. I have an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. Eigenstate has no entropy. So how does it work? Okay, so I will show in the course.
But of course, there's a special non-equilibrium problem because you have only impurity. The only interaction is at one point.
Right.
And the rest is non-interacting.
That's right. One point is not the important thing. Finite region is as good.
Of course.
And the rest is so that I can have a state. But, I mean, you touched on the right point. What I will show later is that this is a scattering. When people say that an eigenstate has no entropy, is what they have in mind is a normalizable eigenstate. While this is a non-normalizable eigenstate defined on the infinite line, and as such, it defines not only the system, but it defines also its environment and the entropy, and it describe what it will describe also is the dissipation of the system into its environment. And that's from the very construction of the system on the infinite line. Okay. So, my next claim is that psi s, which I have constructed this way, is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, of the full Hamiltonian H0 plus H1. And this is a famous theorem in field theory, which tells me that precisely under these conditions, psi s, which evolves, so phi naught is an eigenstate of H0, evolving adiabatically. If this limit exists, then psi s is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. But it's a special eigenstate of the Hamiltonian. It's a time-independent eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, which satisfies the Schrödinger equation, or rather, in this formulation, it's called the Lippmann-Schwinger equation. You see, this is nothing but a Schrödinger equation. If you multiply it here by E minus H naught, it kills this term, and this becomes E psi equals to H psi. Eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, but now I've written it in an integral form with the boundary condition phi naught to which the system tends to at minus infinity. Minus infinity, which means in the far past. And you can recognize what I've done here is what is done in an elementary book on quantum mechanics under the chapter scattering theory. You first describe a wave coming in and scattering, and you are talking about time-dependent description of the wave. It comes in and then goes out. And then comes the next chapter, Lippmann-Schwinger theory, where you are going to a basis of states which are time-independent in which you expand the system, which do just that for you. So that's what I've done. I've gone over from the time-dependent description using U to a time-independent description where I'm trading in the initial condition to a boundary condition. And what I have to do then is to solve the Hamiltonian with a particular boundary condition on the infinite line.
Why do you have to go Foucauldish?
Sorry?
Why do you have to go Foucauldish in this sense?
I don't know.
I've gone directly there, no?
Well, if you accept this, I mean, I just wanted to derive that this is what I need. If you accept this, this is good.
But this regardless of...
Has nothing to do with integrability.
This particular system?
No, has nothing to do with that.
Generic.
This is very generic. This is generic. So this is this part. This is a general impurity. Okay?
But would it be not an impurity, but for instance, tunnel junction,
The same story. This is a very general analysis. As long as the limit T naught to minus infinity exists, and you can switch, and the steady state evolves, then this all of this follows. So this is a quantum mechanical. I've taken this from Merzbacher. You have the waves coming in and scattering out. The difference now that instead of having just a plane wave coming in, I'm going to have two leads coming in. So this is the equivalent picture. I have lead and lead coming in. These are the initial boundary condition, or here you can see it better in an unfolded geometry. You have Fermi C1 and Fermi C2 come in from the far past. Here is the scattering region, and what comes out is a big mess, which we have to calculate. So we are looking for eigenstates of the Hamiltonian, where these are the boundary conditions. So what I'll claim is that this scattering state describes all aspects of non-equilibrium. Non-equilibrium current, energy dissipation, entropy production, whatever you want, as long as these are quantities defined in the steady state. And again, as I emphasized, the reason is that the system, that the eigenstate describes not only the system itself, but also its environment, what has escaped from the system. So, thus far I talked about t equals to zero. At t greater than zero, the same story occurs. So again, at t equals to zero, I had the phi naught, and Lippmann-Schwinger equation gave me a unique state into which evolves psi. More generally, I could start from any boundary condition of the described by some eigenstate of the free Hamiltonian, call it phi n, and Lippmann-Schwinger is going to give me the solution of psi n. So at finite temperature, I have then the starting point of rho naught, which is given by some sum with probabilities defined on the free leads, p naught of n, and those evolve into rho s with the same p naught of n, but now here I have scattering states. And from this, I'm going to construct a rho s with which I'm going to calculate the expectation value. So rho s, you see, by construction commutes with the Hamiltonian, but it's a very non-trivial evolution of rho naught.
Now you require more than time independence, you require diagonality, right?
I don't require, I derive it.
But it
follows, exactly. It follows. And actually, in the paper with Benjamin, we have also shown the result that, what I'm showing that out of equilibrium, O, non-equilibrium, rho s O is given by this rho s, but suppose I turn off the non-equilibrium, I set V to zero, okay? Then we know the answer. We know the answer because Boltzmann told us the answer 100 years ago, namely that rho s is equal to E minus beta H in equilibrium. So we show in the paper how this definition goes over to this when V is zero and we are reverting to equilibrium. So a very interesting question is whether there is some principle, kind of Boltzmannian principle, out of equilibrium which would tell us what rho s without having to go through this complicated and torturous way to construct it. However, notice that still, this result could be surprising, that there is an object, Boltzmann-like rho s, with which we can calculate with the same formalism as in equilibrium, quantities out of equilibrium, albeit in steady state. So the next question is how to construct a psi s or rho s. So, of course, people have been doing it for decades using Keldysh perturbation theory, but typically, because we are interested in systems which are strongly correlated, perturbation theory fails when I'm going beyond some scale like TK. And also RG is inapplicable because phi naught is a very highly excited state. It's not close to the ground state. So the natural question, natural to Bethe Ansatz Afficiandos, is does beta ansatz work out of equilibrium?
What exactly do you mean by strongly correlated here?
Strongly correlated means that strong correlation means that the system cannot be described perturbatively when you go to lower, and in this case, to lower and lower scales, that new collective behavior emerges and new degrees of freedom. And describing the system in terms of the original variables, namely the fermions that I've written down, fails. A perturbation theory does not converge, signaling that totally different physics lies below a certain energy scale. And
For the question for a general system, the status of the statement that the resulting state is described by the nominal dense stimulators and that it is time independent, is it the same conditions are required for that for these two statements? Or one of them is more powerful than the other one.
I'm sorry, the two statements that...
No, there are actually, as I said, there are actually two properties of this final state.
Yes.
Number one, it is time independent.
Yes.
Number two, it is a diagonal dense stimulus.
Yeah.
Okay, what I'm asking is,
typically the
two statements are equally trivial, or some of them...
Typically, if it's diagonal, then it's time independent. Because it commutes with the Hamiltonian. But I didn't put it in by hand, I derived it. Okay. I derived it under the condition that a steady state is achieved. Okay.
In this derivation, you used the specific problem. You couldn't do that.
I used the Kondo,
yeah.
Hamiltonian.
Impurity conditions.
Impurity, that's right. But if you look at the proof, you can see how to generalize it to, I mean, what goes into that is that you can take certain limits of T naught goes to minus infinity, and the properties do not depend so much on the specifics of the problem as on the properties of the leads. And therefore, what I'm saying, it would also work for problems where you have not necessarily one impurity here, but rather some more general
localized
structure. Well, otherwise I cannot even talk about, so when I'm talking about scattering, the whole setup is that I have a localized part of space where interaction takes place, which is described by H, and then I have the far region, which are described by H naught. And the whole problem is this interplay between states defined on H naught, which come in and scatter in H and go out to H naught. So I need to be able to separate my space into these two regimes, otherwise I don't have a scattering theory.
But what's the difference from what they were doing in the 50s when they invented scattering theory?
But it is scattering theory, but now I'm doing many-body scattering theory for a strongly correlated system. So I'm using precisely Littmann-Schwinger, which was done in the 50s, but it was done for quantum mechanics. Okay, so what I'm going to show is that precisely this quantity that I'm defining through scattering theory, I can construct exactly. Okay?
You say that this is in the limited region, the interaction. Is that then must be exponential decay or...
I imagine something like that. I did not study this in detail, but I imagine, I mean, even in scattering theory, people have problem when the center, when V goes like 1 over R, you know there are logarithmic corrections and all that. So in order to have a proper scattering theory, this must be larger than 1. Okay? But
so far, the proof of the existence of a steady state, this
yes.
is new compared to what
yes.
we were doing in the 50s, or this is...
Nobody applied this to steady state of impurity. In the 50s, people talked about electrons scattering over some center.
Potential. Yeah, but what's the difference? Isn't it the same thing?
You have free electrons coming in.
Yes.
And on the dot, you have just two states.
Yes. Well, you're asking me about the, what, why the condo problem is trivial or not trivial? This is the condo problem. The condo problem is a strongly correlated system. Now, you are saying, how can a system be correlated by a single spin? Is that your question?
If people are asking what the difference is between this problem and scattering theory and nuclear physics, is it right to say that the point is here you have not just individual particles instant, but a filled Fermi C?
I have a filled Fermi C.
And that's what makes it different.
Yeah. I have more than that.
I have a related question to this. In nuclear physics, standard formulation, when we talk about quantum mechanics, no Fermi C, nothing.
All right.
Is there a steady state possible?
If you create a scattering experiment where you have a stream of electrons correlated coming in, then you would have a steady state.
Even if instead of impurity, it is a nuclear.
Yeah. That's right.
Hydrogen.
Yeah.
Still.
Yeah. But let me answer the question about. What is the difference between a potential and electrons coming in? So when you have a potential and electron coming in, electron 1 and electron 2, electron 1 coming, crossing the impurity, we leave it in a state which is unchanged, and electron 2 will not know about that. So they are uncorrelated. However, if you have here an impurity, and I'm writing the simplest one, a spin, and electron one has, let's say, a spin. So once it crosses the impurity flips, and I am in this situation at electron one here. And now when two comes in, it is in a different state than before. So it depends which one comes first, one or two. In other words, correlations are generated among the local correlations, are generated around the electrons, and that is the essence of what is called the Kondo effect. And you can show that these correlations become stronger and stronger when you are probing the system at lower and lower energies, in the sense that the effective coupling of each impurity, of each electron to the impurity, let me call J, and in the sense of renormalization group, let me allow it to depend on the energy, it is weaker when E is large, and stronger when E is going to zero. In particular, in a very precise limit, it goes to infinity when E goes to zero. And then you're reaching the Kondo effect, where the impurity is completely screened by an electron which is coupled to it, and it disappears from the spectrum, leaving behind an effective potential, which a virtual potential over the other electrons can scatter. So
Well, I'm still confused because your leads, you're modeling the electrons as non-interacting, right?
Exactly.
And then when you do positron-electron scattering, you only have one electron coming from the right or the left, or a positron. Is the difference between what they do in CERN and what you're doing simply that you're working with a finite Fermi surface in the leads? That's the only difference.
Yeah, which makes it an infinite.
Which makes it much more complicated.
Which is an infinite.
Well, it's not interacting still. It's what
no, I mean, look, in QED, you can say in QED, electrons do not interact.
Well, they don't interact in your leads either.
But in QED, electrons do not interact, yeah. They just exchange photons.
Yes.
So here the electrons do not interact, they just exchange the spin.
Yes. So in what sense is it different?
Because the whole point is that there's a lot of interaction. And whenever the electrons come to the impurity, there they interact. But they will not interact in the lead. I mean, so in that sense, of course, it's simplification. But you still have this local interaction. You know, it's not a field theory.
It is a very strongly coupled theory. Okay. It's not interactions in the bulk. You are looking at the physics of how the impurity changes due to its interaction with the electron. Of course, one impurity cannot correlate all electrons, cannot create a gap. But that is not the essence of the question. The essence of the question is how does the impurity get modified by its interaction with the Fermi C. So what you are measuring are quantities, let's say, in equilibrium. What is the susceptibility as a function of the temperature? Let's say the susceptibility, the impurity susceptibility, would have been a free electron. A free impurity would have the susceptibility that goes like 1 over T. That's the Curie law. And what you measure in the lab is, in a metal, if you put the impurity in the metal, is that instead of going and diverging, there is a crossover at some TK below which the physics is very different and the susceptibility is finite.
Yeah, in other words, so compared to nuclear physics, it's the same problem, the same difficulty level, except that you're looking at different observables. You care here about what's happening in the dot,
where that's right.
You only care about the cross sections. And they would not.
I can
the scattering of this spin interacting with the electrons, the scattering S matrix depends crucially on there being an impurity and on the thing being interacting.
Right,
for example, this has particle production. Right?
Like in nuclear physics.
Yeah.
So there's no difference in some sense.
So fine, so I solved also a nuclear physics problem. but I can also calculate, I will show later if you ask me, how. So if I have here an impurity and I have an electron coming in above a Fermi C, how it scatters, and this is precisely a scattering that nuclear physicists do, but they don't have a Fermi C, or that if they have a Dirac C under it, there is a gap, and so it doesn't get really excited. Well, here all the fun is that the Fermi C is strongly modifying the whole physics.
Fermi C in the lead.
The lead is a Fermi C.
Let me come to this steady state question. Suppose let's think that the Fermi C has a finite width, some Fermi energy, not infinite.
Yes.
Finite, yeah?
Right.
The bandwidth.
Yeah.
So it's not. Fermi C, but
right.
In which extent there will be a steady state in this case as well?
No, that's a good.
Energy introduced a certain time.
That's a good question. But so if I have, so if this is my bandwidth, and I'll call this, let's say, minus D, which I typically send to minus infinity.
Yeah, but now we don't.
And now we don't. So why do I send it to minus infinity to begin with? Of course, this in a real metal, it is always finite. But the questions that I'm asking are typically questions around the Fermi C. So as long as a typical energy scale, epsilon, is very small compared to D, then I can think of D as being infinite.
Yeah, so
if I keep it finite, well,
it's an equilibrium problem.
Yeah.
Does this time? So
yeah, there would be some. No, it will. Well, it would destroy maybe on a scale of D, which are very, very long.
Yeah, this is what I would
yeah.
Because D is energy, it's large.
Time,
short.
Right.
In which sense the steady state would destroy it in this case?
It would be probably. It could. I'm not sure. I didn't study this question. It could be destroyed on very, very large time scales.
No, small.
No, it cannot depend. It cannot depend on D. I mean, it would be 1 over D effects.
Yeah, which is very small.
Very small. No, it's H.
So there are actually several types.
There are a lot. Yeah.
Which is very short. And
yeah.
Then there is a quantum time, which is
no. So
very large.
So what will this may enter also into the time of the transients, rather than the.
So you're saying that even in this case, at large time,
there will be steady state.
But then I can continue collapse this Fermi C to nothing.
The point is you cannot collapse it to nothing because you have and that is why RG doesn't work because you have a V here.
So
you cannot the whole procedure of collapsing it.
The point is that as soon as I continue spectrum,
yes.
Any kind,
That's right.
At lunch time, after the present time, will be steady state.
Yes. That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
It is not the Fermi C important, but
it's the Fermi spectrum. Yeah, it is the spectrum, the density, the continuous density, and no singularities, which makes it a Fermi C probably. Okay. So thus far, I was talking about very general systems. And now I want to go, actually, the question how to construct such scattering states. So in particular, can we use the Bethe ansatz to construct such scattering states? So as I emphasized, traditional Bethe ansatz is based on imposing periodic boundary condition and sort of you define the system on a ring of size L, and then you take L to infinity. And this is an excellent way of getting out all the thermodynamics and describing equilibrium physics. But for non-equilibrium or for scattering, it doesn't work. You need an open system so as to allow you in and out. So in and out either as a scattering experiment or in and out as flow of energy into the system and out of the system. So what you need to develop is a new formulation of the Bethe ansatz, which allows you to solve the problem directly on the infinite line. And now you have to select your states, not by looking at periodic boundary condition, but by saying, I want a state which is an eigenstate of a Hamiltonian, which has a particularly prescribed behavior at minus infinity. Namely, when I'm going to minus infinity, the eigenstate looks like two Fermi Cs. And that's just like a scattering problem that Lippmann-Schwinger were talking about. They were saying, look at an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, which far away looks like a plane wave. Except that now we have strongly correlated system with two Fermi Cs. So we have then developed a formulation which is called the scattering Bethe ansatz, allows construction on the infinite line of a basis of eigenstate with prescribed asymptotic behavior. It allows to ask all kinds of questions. For example, how do the non-equilibrium boundary condition, do they interfere with integrability? Does it allow integrability out of equilibrium, and so on and so forth? So rather than giving a very general discussion, I will show how to construct it in a very specific model where I have an impurity. I will not talk yet about the Kondo problem. I'll talk about the interacting resonance level model. So you have two leads written down here. You have a level D, which can be occupied or unoccupied. The minimum for an impurity to be qualified as a quantum impurity is that it has two states which change under the interaction or passing of electrons. So this level can be occupied or unoccupied, that is either spin one or spin down. So electrons can hop on and off. And then there is a Coulomb interaction between the electron sitting on the, if an electron sits on the dot, then it would repulse electrons in the leads, and that's given by this U. This model was shown by Digman and Finkelstein, thank you. By Finkelstein to be equivalent to an anisotropic Kondo model. Here it's written, if you do bosonization, you can transform the spin physics into charge physics and you get this model. So this is again related to the Kondo model. So
can I check the fermions here are spinless? Or?
Spinless. So the charge plays the role of the spin. So here I've rewritten the Hamiltonian in a linearized unfolded way as two right movers interacting with the localized electrons. Here is the hopping on and off D, and here is the Coulomb interaction. So what I want now to do is to diagonalize this Hamiltonian via scattering beta ansatz on the infinite line. So to go about it, if you look at this Hamiltonian, it's convenient to write a psi even odd as a linear combination of 1 and 2. So the Hamiltonian decouples into two parts. So you have even electrons, and you have the impurity, and the even electrons can hop on and off the impurity, and there is the Coulomb interaction. And you have odd electrons, they cannot hop on and off, so they just see the impurity here fluctuating. So this, the even part was shown by Filiov and Wigman in 1980 to be integrable. And what I will show is that one can use the solution to construct a solution for the full system on the infinite line. What is important is to note that this even odd basis is convenient to rewrite the Hamiltonian in this language, but in order to impose the boundary condition, I have to go back to the 1-2 basis. And that is a central theme here, how to go back to the interacting basis, to the basis in which boundary conditions are written down. Okay, so here it becomes a little bit technical. So how does one do beta ansatz? One does it in the most naive way. You notice that the Hamiltonian that I've written down here conserves the number of electrons. You see here the number of electrons is conserved. If I annihilate a d, I create a psi and vice versa. So the numbers of electrons, if I count on d and in the bath, is conserved, and I will therefore be able to construct the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian a one by one by one, first one, then two, then three, and then I'll fill the Fermi C. Sorry, it rhymes. So here it's what I'm doing. But I want to emphasize that by having already started with a single electron, I emptied the Dirac C, which means this is a highly cut-off theory. And it's only when I fill the full Fermi C that I will regain field theory. So field theory is obtained once I take the limit. First, the limit where the cutoff is taken to infinity and the Fermi C is completely filled. Okay, so this is really an exercise in second quantization. The most general state of one electron consists of a psi e with its wave function, of a d and its wave function, and of an h and its wave function, and I can solve them separately. And in other words, you write the state, you act with the Hamiltonian on it, you get Schrödinger equations, you solve the Schrödinger equations, and you get these single particle wave functions. So what you have here is that the electron, when it passes from minus infinity to plus infinity, it picks up a phase shift EI delta P, which I've written down here. And H plus minus is a plane wave, but I have chosen to a basis where I don't have just plane wave, I've introduced a discontinuity. It's still a solution, and it's for my convenience, more than my convenience. It's imposed on me by consistency to choose a discontinuity at the point zero, but I have still a solution which is of the free a non-interacting Hamiltonian.
Nacho, there's one thing I somehow seem to be missing. At x equals zero, this function hp has one value, and
right.
At x not equals zero, it has another value.
Yes.
If I integrate over this, it's a measure zero, so any integral will never see this.
For one electron, this has no effect on the physics, but when I consider this and I build up a set of states out of it, it plays a role.
Can it have any effect if it never enters an integral?
Sorry?
It never enters any integrals.
No, I'm not doing integrals. I'm solving equations. And these equations are coupled together. And sort of this value enters when I do the coupling, because everything happens at the point zero. Okay. Okay. So once I have written it out in this language of even and odd, I will go back now to the basis of 1 and 2. And in other words, all I have to write here, psi even is a 1 plus 2, and psi odd is 1 minus 2. That's what I've done here. And so this is the wave function. So this is a general eigenstate for any value of p. And at this point, I've not even imposed boundary conditions. The boundary conditions that I'm going to impose come now, and they are that when I go to minus infinity, I have, let's say, only electron coming in from lead one, or in which case I will choose A equals to B, so you see whatever comes in from lead B is zero. Or I can choose the boundary condition, which I'll call two, in which case I set A equals to minus B, then I don't have this term, and I have only electrons coming in from lead two. So imposing these boundary conditions, I have the following scattering state, single electron scattering state. Single electrons, there is no Fermi C yet. So I've chosen A and B so that I have a type 1 electrons, 1p. These are eigenstates. An electron comes in only from 1. I have this term. And then it is reflected. Remember, this is unfolded. So what goes here is a reflection. Or it is transmitted. It's this term. And there is, of course, a wave function for the electron to sit on the impurity. This, as I said, corresponds to A equals to B. And similarly, I have another single particle scattering state where I've chosen the boundary condition so that I have only an electron coming from B. Now, the incoming term, which is described by theta minus x, is associated with psi 2. And again, this is a reflection and this is a transmission.
Did we use this condition already anywhere that we just discussed where A was zero with some value?
Not yet.
It wasn't used.
Not here, it doesn't play a role. This is a typical Bethe Ansatz physics. Yeah. I prepare the basis for having three particles. It's like in the usual Kondo problem, let's say, if I'm looking at two electrons, then the Hamiltonian is d1 plus d2, right? And every sane person will write a solution, eik1 x1 plus ik2 x2 equals to e with this equals to that, okay? But you could write down, actually, any linear combination of this where I add a q and minus q, because it's the energy, which is k1 plus k2, is infinitely degenerate. k1 plus q plus k2 minus q. So I can choose, actually, not only this, which is sort of the simplest and most natural, eik1 x1 plus ik2 x2, I can write here times any function x1 minus x2, and f could be arbitrary, because my d1 plus d2 does not see this function. Now you say, why should I choose anything in particular? It's only when I'm going to the three particle level, it turns out that what I have to choose here is something of the form A, theta x1 minus x2, a1, a2, for the Kondo problem they have a spin, plus a pa, kind of an S matrix, which is not 1, to be theta x2 minus x1. Okay? Only for S equals to 1 do I have the naive solution. But why do I choose a non-naive solution? It's because I have to satisfy at the level of three particles a Young-Baxter condition, and it imposes this. So the same story goes through here. Here you don't see why I chose it, and it makes no difference. But when I'm going to the next level, it makes the same.
Nathan,
yeah.
You have used Bethe Ansatz something here?
Not yet. No. This is not Bethe Ansatz. This is exercise which I give to students that learn second quantization. It's not even scattering. Just solve the Hamiltonian. Take a second. Usually we do first quantization and go to second. Here I'm going from second to first. That's all there is to it.
Would be convenient to break, or you want to continue without?
No, I can do either. I mean, probably break is good.
Is this right?
This is a good point.
So 5 minutes.
By the way, I should mention that there is large overlap with the work that I've done with the work of Andreas, Saleur, Fendley, Koenig, although there are also some important differences, but they were the first to use integrability, but in this context. Okay. So, I've done, the Bethe Ansatz has not yet started playing a role. I just did an exercise in first quantization, and notice that the way I've set up the problem, the scattering states, the boundary condition that I've put in could be translated that this operator alpha 1, which creates states with boundary condition 1, goes to psi when x goes to, so alpha 1 goes to psi 1, alpha 2 goes to psi 2 when x is negative. So you see when psi 1, when x is negative, only this term survives. This is the psi 1. In psi 2, only this term survives. These are the boundary condition built into the formalism. And whatever comes out is not seen when I'm here. So here, in this part, I have an eigenstate of H naught of a particular prescribed form. Okay, the main fun begins when one looks at two particles. And then, so now the most, do people see that? Or?
You see it in my green.
Okay, I'll read it out. So, it looks awful. So, let's say two electron problem has psi even, psi even, psi odd, psi odd, psi even, psi odd, psi even d, and psi odd d. Okay, so this is the most general two-particle problem. You act on the Hamiltonian with this state.
So initially you had used the psi 1, psi 2 basis, is it correct? It doesn't matter for which one.
No, psi 1, so when I want to solve for eigenstate, I go to the basis even odd.
Okay.
When I want to impose boundary conditions, I go to 1 and 2. So now I want to solve an eigenstate, so I go to 1 and 2. A2 even odd, and I'm writing down the most general wave function. And you see I have a function g x1 x2, h of x1 x2, etc., etc. I have five functions. They are all coupled by Schrödinger equations, and I need to solve them. And here I'm doing the Bethe Ansatz. I'm showing that the function g of x1, x2 can be written as a product of single particle wave function gp x1, which I have found, gk x2, times some function of x1 minus x2, and this function of course, is not seen by d x1 minus x2 because it's function of the difference, minus 1 and 2. This was first written down by Paul Bigman for the even case. Similarly, for the other ones, you write down an ansatz, and you have then to do a lot of work, about 5 pages of computation. And what you find is that at the end, this ansatz is consistent, and this is an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian when this function z is just a scattering phase shift, namely z x1 minus x2 is of the form ei phi, some phase that depends on the two scattering particles, momenta pk, signum x1 minus x2. So it's a constant to the left, a constant to the right, and here is the phase shift. So what you can show then is that for 2 electrons, that's better.
Better now?
Maybe these. This is an old transparency which I've not rewritten, so I obviously have to rewrite it. Okay.
This is only this slide.
Yeah. The rest I use PowerPoint. This is sort of from LaTeX.
That's still working?
Yes. No, but that's good. Yeah. So you see, the essence of beta ansatz shows up here, that I know how to write wave functions of 2 particles in terms of wave functions of the one particle problems with a scattering between particle 1 and 2. Okay? So this is still a general eigenstate because I've not specified boundary conditions which are going to determine A, B, and C. When I do that, when I specify the boundary conditions and I generalize this construction to more than 2, then I can find, here it's more reasonable, that a general scattering eigenstate has the following form. So it is characterized by momenta P1 to Pn, where n is n1 plus n2. So I have n1 coming in from lead 1, N2 coming in from lead 2. As you can see, alpha 1 goes from up to N1, N1 of these, N2 of these. However, with unlike the case of, if I did not have any interaction, this would be an eigenstate of the Hamiltonian, and the interactions introduce a scattering among all these particles written in the basis alpha 1 and alpha 2.
It's just a matter of notation. What is it? U and V? What is U and V?
U goes from 1.
These are indices.
Indices. U goes from.
Is it different from IMJ?
No, it's just a nerdy notation.
Yeah,
U goes from 1 to N1, V goes from 1 to N2, and I goes from 1 to N, which is the sum. That is. Okay? So what we have shown, and this is sort of a long calculation, that indeed the eigenstate can be written down in this form, where remember the alpha 1 creates a single particle coming in, 1 coming in here and scattering here and here, 2 comes in here and scatters here and here. So N1 and N2 are going to be determined by mu1 and mu2. And they describe a scattering state. I don't know which scattering state that will be come later, but this is a scattering state with N1 and N2 particles. And this is eigenstate for each choice of P with energy just given by sum of the P's. And it's a complete set of states, and we still have now to impose the non-equilibrium boundary condition to determine the momenta p.
I think it would be instructive if you showed us again what alpha 1 and alpha 2 were, these single particle states.
So alpha 1 here is this state. So I have the particle 1 coming in from minus infinity is reflected to that. So 1 comes in, is reflected. Remember, this is a reflection after the 40. And also scattered to 2 by the impurity. It can hop here and here. So I have this amplitude. And alpha 2 is the same system. So this is a general basis, and if I did not have interaction, if everything was quadratic, then of course just products of these alphas would be eigenstates. And by doing, if you have just this, you can indeed recover Landau's result. For example, So if U is 0, U being the Coulomb interaction, then S is equal to 1. This is just a product, and this is just a quadratic Hamiltonian, and you get just single product of single particle states being eigenstates. And our first calculation was to show that, indeed, in this case, you recovered the free Landau result. That was a very important way for us to do it via a state formalism.
Sorry, which result did you cover?
The results of Landauer, that the current is given by.
Okay.
So, what is it exactly in the problem that says the only effect of scattering is to produce its phase factor and not to change the numbers of particles n1 and n2?
Alpha 1. The number of particles do change, because in each alpha there is also 1 and 2. The alphas do not change. Here, let me. So in each, when you do that, I have n. The numbers of particles is not 1 and 2 is not determined.
What I mean is that, as you explained, without interactions. An eigenstate would
be an eigenstate. This would be an eigenstate.
So, how is it that when you turn interactions on, you don't need to build eigenstates out of superpositions of states with different numbers n1 and n2? Is that
that's integrability? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
But I just want to emphasize the alphas. Does not mean that I have a fixed number of particles here and here. They're all mixed together. But indeed, integrability means that I can just expand in this basis, that this is a good basis which is preserved when I turn on interaction. Okay. Okay, now comes, in a sense, the heart of the question. How to impose boundary condition? What I did construct is a complete set of states. So now I have to take my state P, my fully interacting state, and I want to study it to the far left, where I want to impose the boundary condition that the wave functions have to look like two Fermi Cs. Now, when I study what the state looks like in the far left, namely when x I go to minus infinity, you see the alphas became psis, and if I didn't have this factor here, it would look like a Fermi C. But I have this factor here, and this factor here looks like a scattering matrix, but actually it is not a scattering matrix because all the electrons are right movers. What this S matrix is really a choice of bases. And let me explain it maybe in some. Okay, I'm explaining it here. So, because all electrons are right movers with the same velocity, the S matrix is a choice of bases in the following sense. this is the Hamiltonian of, remember, now we are far to the left of the impurity. There are no interactions. The Hamiltonian is just a free Hamiltonian, D1 plus D2. So that's all there is to it. And as I explained earlier, I can choose a wave function with arbitrary function here as long as it's function of x1 and x2. Putting an S matrix different from 1 introduces discontinuities, and these discontinuities are in a sense natural in the problem. If you remember what we learned, again, in quantum mechanics, third year, if you have a level, can I turn on the light? So imagine I have a level which is degenerate. All of these levels have the same energy. In my case, this level is infinitely degenerate, if you remember, because I could add or subtract any q. Now I turn on an interaction, and these levels are going to spread out. But if I turn off the interaction, they come back to some linear combination, which may not be the one that I thought I started with. It's the interaction itself that determines to which linear combination you come back to. Okay? And that is the correct, in a sense, what we learn when we do quantum mechanics. We say if we have levels I, we have to form a linear combination of I's, A alpha I, so that the interaction in those states has alpha and beta has to be diagonal, otherwise we cannot turn on the interaction. And it's this very complicated linear combination is the one that I obtain by turning off the interaction, or in this case, the one to which I'm going when x is at minus infinity, when I'm going from the fully interacting Hamiltonian state with the alpha 1 and alpha 2 to this eigenstate of the free Hamiltonian where I have psi 1 and psi 2. So the question then is, how do I express the original boundary conditions in this basis? This is, I'll call it the beta basis, the basis in the free Hamiltonian to which I'm returning after I turn off the Hamiltonian, the interaction. So the boundary conditions are written in the basis S equals to 1, which I call the Fock basis. When I have a non-trivial scattering matrix, I have a beta basis. And I have now to rotate the boundary condition in such a way that since they are imposed here, I have to express them in this basis. Okay? So that is the next question. So here I'm saying again, if S is 1, then I have a Fock basis, and then the Fermi momenta are distributed as a Fermi Dirac distribution. At t equals to 0, it would be a theta function, 1 up to mu 1 and mu 2, and 0 otherwise. Now, when S is different from 1, I can still express exactly the same Fermi C in this new basis, but it will be a much more complicated description, and for which I will have to write down a beta ansatz equation. So, this is what I have to do. This is a general state described by P1 to Pn. It tends to this particular state. But what I really want is this. So I have to connect one to the other. And to do that, I'm going to go to an auxiliary problem. This becomes a standard question in beta ansatz technology now. So I'm looking for a ground state in of the Hamiltonian with a certain set of S matrices. So I can put the problem on a ring of length L. Now this is not the ring of the physical original problem. There I've taken the infinite line to begin with. This is an auxiliary problem that allows me just to determine the momenta Pj. so I'm writing it, you take an electron, you take it past all other electrons, you pick up all the S matrices and come back, and the PJs in the presence of these S matrices therefore must satisfy this equation. In the Fock basis, S is equal to 1, and we get just EIPJL is equal to 1, and we get the usual Fock distribution. Now instead, what we get is a Bethe-Ansatz equation, which where PJ is coupled to all other momenta, and it's characterized by some integers. And the ground state is obtained when all these integers are chosen in a particular way, namely that they are consecutive, and that gives the ground state in this description. So this is going to be the same state that I wanted, namely the two Fermi Cs, however, written down in a very complicated basis which is induced in the free theory through the interactions. And again, these are standard manipulations. When you are going to the limit now of an infinite number of particles, you are not interested anymore in the individual momenta p's, you are interested in the density, and you can turn the Bethe-Ansatz equations that I've written out before into integral equations for the density of momenta rho 1p and rho 2p. So rho 1p is this term. This is what would have been the Fermi-Dirac distribution with momenta running up to k not 1. K not 1 is related to mu 1. K not 2 is related to mu 2. But because the S matrix is non-trivial, you have now an integral equation where this fancy k is just the logarithmic derivative of S, which couples rho 1 to rho 2. To rho 1 to rho 1 up to k not 1, and rho 2 up to k not 2, and similarly rho 2 is coupled to these equations. So these equations are the Bethe-Ansatz in the free theory, but with a crazy basis. And a small comment, that the epsilon d has to be here positive, it has to be above the Fermi, I should have written larger than mu 1 and mu 2. That's a technical comment. Let me not worry about that. So, what you have to do is to solve for rho 1 and rho 2. You solve these Bethe-Ansatz equations, and then you have the full description of the scattering state. Now what you do with it, that's the third part. What you want to calculate are observables. One observable is, I'm sorry, this shouldn't be a V, should be a T. One observable is the current, which describes the number of particles crossing from 1 to 2. And the other variable is the dot occupation, how many electrons sit on the dot out of equilibrium. So now comes a non-trivial calculation, but it's very neat, and it simplifies enormously when we take the volume to infinity, because a lot of terms vanish because of order 1 over L. So what you have to do is calculate I in these states which I've written down. And the result is actually simple. The result is that the current is given by some kernel, a tunneling kernel of the delta. Delta is T square. Delta square divided by P minus epsilon square plus delta square.
Minus with delta, what is it again?
Delta is T square.
And T square is the hopping?
P is the hopping.
Is the hopping between any one of the two leads into the
D.
Localized level with
right.
D electrons?
Right. It merits. So I have a T, which is this. Thank you. So T is the hopping T, psi dagger 1 plus psi dagger 2 into D plus emission conjugate. T actually tells you how this level widens, because it's not now that it mixes with the continuum, it's no longer sharp level, and that's why this width is called delta, which is T square. Usually you see it in the literature as pi rho T square, but we chose our, pi nu, density of states, because we linearize, we chose our density of states nu to be 1 over pi, so it's just T squared, then it looks unfamiliar. So this is the current. Now, here you see, if I did not have a interaction, rho 1 would be just theta 1, and rho 2 would be just theta 2, and this is the lambda result. But because of the interaction, they are modified. And they to determine them, I have to solve this Bethe-Ansatz equation. And similarly, Nd is given by rho 1 plus rho 2 with a similar kernel. And the reason that you ask yourself, why is it so simple? The reason is that the the reason is actually very profound. The Bethe-Ansatz chooses a particular basis for you in which the electrons, when they cross the impurity, they cross by phase shifts. The transformation into this basis is very complicated, but in this basis, the calculation becomes simple.
You have complicated things and the difference in chemical potentials? Or
yeah. Yeah. You have to solve it. You see here. That's right. So the case which depends on to determine precisely how it, I need another equation. I need an equation an integral rho 1 of t dp from k naught 2 to k naught 1, and that is the voltage. That is the number, the additional number of particles here. Well, times L over pi. So the voltage comes in here, the choice of k naught 1, k naught 2, which has to be determined self-consistently.
To be very large, it seems that you get a finite current.
I get. Here. That's what I get.
Okay.
So, by now we also have analytic solutions. These type of equations can be solved by some technique called the Wiener-Hopf equation, although in this case it's coupled Wiener-Hopf and it's a bit of a headache. But you can do it numerically. That means. My students can. And what you find is current as a function of voltage for different U's. And this is still at T equals to zero. The generalization to finite temperature is actually very simple. It's it's an old technique in the Bethe-Ansatz to go from zero temperature to finite temperature by adding the entropy and getting new types of equations. So this generalization is simple. So here you get at T equals to zero, the voltage, the current is a function of the voltage. And here the occupation as a current is a function of the voltage.
Do you understand physically why the current saturates with large voltage?
I don't think it saturates. It goes it goes up. I think it goes up like a power. It goes like a power. I think this power is sort of an X-ray. Sorry?
Shouldn't it be one? I mean, at large voltages, you'd think you'd cross over to some non-interacting behavior.
Yeah. I would think it goes like a power.
So it is
the X-ray.
At large V, you just forget about all this.
The scattering phase shift, basically. It's like an X-ray exponent.
But I just thought,
yeah.
And you can show, for example, that if you change the cutoff, then you can compensate it in changes in U and in delta. You can begin to explore questions of universality out of equilibrium.
We don't expect it to be universal for large bias, for example.
No. But first you take the cutoff to infinity. When I'm saying large bias, I mean large or small compared to TK, not compared to D. D is always the largest problem. Otherwise, I don't have universality. Thank you. Yeah, all the physical scales are very small compared to the cutoff. Otherwise, I cannot talk about the field theory. U is the coupling, the Coulomb coupling. U, psi dagger 1, psi 1, plus psi dagger 2, psi 2, d. So U...
D dagger d,
thank you. D dagger d. So it tells you that when you are, when this level is occupied, then it repulses the electrons here and impedes tunneling. Okay. So let me just summarize the difference between the traditional and the scattering. So the scattering, the system is directly infinite, while the traditional beta ansatz is finite. Boundary conditions is asymptotic on an open, while here it's periodic. The wave functions are used explicitly, while in the TBA, we usually exploit the condition on periodicity, but not the wave function itself. The thermodynamics doing here is very difficult. You have to calculate expectation values, while in the TBA it's relatively easy. But what you lose here, you gain here, that your scattering properties could be calculated using the scattering beta ansatz, while the TBA it's not possible. And also this formulation allows, since you can do scattering, you can do also non-equilibrium, while you cannot do it here. And there are many other applications which I, let me not discuss in, right now. Okay, so now I've done the construction for the resonance level model. Let me go over to the Kondo model, which has been the first motivation. So here is the setup. How much time do I have? 5 minutes. Okay, I'll just run through the transparencies and I'll summarize. So this is the setup. This is the free Hamiltonian, two leads. Now they carry spin. This is the voltage plays the role of a flavor field. This is flavor 1 and 2. And I put in a flavor field and I get a difference in the filling. And the interaction is the Kondo interaction. And what one has to do, remember the elements that went into my constructions were calculations of the S matrices of scattering of the electron of the impurity and of the electrons and induced scattering of electrons induced by the bases. So the same thing goes through here. Here is the electron impurity S matrix, which you can calculate by following a very similar procedure to the one I did before. SJK is the single channel scattering S matrix of the Kondo model. And here it's written now in the basis of 1, 2. And electron-electron scattering matrix consistency requires that it takes this form of scattering of the in the spin channel and in the flavor channel. And this is actually exactly the S matrix which appears in the two-channel Kondo. The electrons scatter off each other, scatter in the sense this is induced scattering through the impurity by this S matrix. And you construct the scattering matrix with momenta, Kj, except that now life is much more exciting, and you have to solve much more complicated Bethe-Ansatz equations. You have to take into account also complex solution, which are typically called string solution. The string solution describe the electrons which are up to here, where K, the complex K, describes the filling here and here, and real momenta K, I'm get that, if you don't understand it, I know it's mumbo jumbo, it's described here.
I have a question. When you solve when you get beta stuff, is it the same as in a closed system, or is it
the same?
Are those the same as the in a closed system? Is there
in, as the same as
in a closed system?
No. Well, in a closed system, asking what question?
Those scattering phase shifts there are those different equations? They are basically
scattering phase shifts. Where
the k delta?
These are momenta.
Oh yeah,
and. These are Bethe-Ansatz equations for the free Hamiltonian, free. Usually when you do TBA, you have the full Hamiltonian, including the impurity. My Bethe-Ansatz here are for the free part. I've done with the impurity already. I solved the problem, the scattering problem, by constructing the scattering state with the impurity.
There are no equations there. Okay.
There are no Bethe-Ansatz equations. There are equations, Schrödinger equations, to diagonalize the Hamiltonian, and which determine the scattering matrices.
People seem to sense an equal zero.
But that would, you're exactly right. If N1 is equal to N2, then you do not recover the usual TBA equation. You recover the thermodynamics via scattering Bethe-Ansatz. Okay, these equations, in the usual Bethe-Ansatz equation, there is here another term where the impurity scattering enters. This is the free part. Okay, this is here I'm diagonalizing a free Hamiltonian in a crazy basis, in a Bethe basis. Okay. While the traditional Bethe-Ansatz, you do everything at the same time. So here I divided the job into two parts. The first part, I'm dealing in the infinite line and diagonalizing Hamiltonian on the infinite line. The second part, I'm looking far away from the impurity, where the Hamiltonian is free, and I'm writing Bethe-Ansatz there to describe the momenta that go into the original part. And this is what these equations are. The Bethe-Ansatz equation enter differently than in the traditional Bethe. In the traditional Bethe-Ansatz, everything is done at the same time. The diagonalization and the determination of the momenta. While here, it's done in two parts. You first diagonalize on the infinite line. The momenta are undetermined. They are later determined by imposing the periodic boundary conditions that lead to the Bethe-Ansatz equations. You can do it by sending these to zero. In other words, sending the voltage to zero. Then you can see it. Okay. Yeah, you can compare it. And, yeah.
Is there something similar to the effect if you take the normal Bethe-Ansatz and then you compare the evolution?
No, the normal Bethe-Ansatz doesn't have non-equilibrium.
Yes, that's
But so in order to compare equilibrium and non-equilibrium, you have to work in this formulation, which allows non-equilibrium. So I have to write here, and then I can regain equilibrium by sending N1 to N2. So to answer your question, here you can compare row 1 and row 2 as a function of the voltage for zero or not zero.
Okay.
It's mumbo jumbo. It's, I know that probably only Paul understands this comment. So.
She does.
Yeah, but I mean, it's not for general audience.
She will give a talk.
So should I answer this question?
About this
okay.
Things and stuff.
Okay. No. I'm happy to talk about that, but I. But this is very technical, and I did not. I'm happy to talk about strings here, but. All right. Let me find. Here are the equations that the rows must satisfy. Blah blah blah. Here is what you have to calculate, and please stay tuned. Okay.
So what is the expression for? This is the expression for the current.
Here is the current
temperature in terms
of row one of the densities once you have solved for the densities explicitly. Plus and minus mean. Again, a Wiener-Hopf mumbo jumbo.
The infinite sum comes from Wiener-Hopf.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I was going to ask you, how does it compare with experiments?
Not yet. I hope in a couple of months. Okay. Oops, what did I do? Sorry. Okay. Do I have a few minutes for entropy production, or?
Yes. Why don't we have 5 minutes for entropy
okay.
production? Does that work?
Yeah. Okay. So.
But Nathan, you didn't know that. So why you cannot compare the experiments?
Because I didn't finish the calculation.
You don't have the explicit solution.
That's right. So I hope soon. It's complicated equation, so.
But you had the IV curves before.
Yeah, but that was for another model.
But this one, how does it compare to experiments today?
Well, I don't know of experiments that weren't done exactly for this model.
Maybe we can have that discussion after.
So when we have non-equilibrium, you expect entropy to be produced. And as I said, when you have when you describe the system by an eigenstate, you are a bit suspicious that entropy is not going to produce. But actually, the reason that here we do have entropy production is, of course, that the states that we are describing are scattering states on the infinite line, non-normalizable, very nasty objects, which describe not only the system, but also all those electrons that escape into the environment. So let me give first a definition of the entropy, what I call thermodynamic definition. There is another definition which we are trying to give, which goes through entanglement, but this we don't understand it completely yet. So what is the heat released to environment? DQI is, for I is 1 and 2, is DEI minus mu I dN. But now we can calculate the rate of energy current just by looking at H, commutator H at H naught, and this is the energy current, and dN1 dt is the N1 current, namely the number current, which was my main subject of discussion thus far.
And so 1 and 2label
the leads. So the rate of entropy production. Now the point here is why can we give a thermodynamic description is because our system is very special. It's an impurity system, which is what is called in the mathematical literature a discontinuous system. It's made out of two pieces which are essentially in equilibrium, and there is 1 over L current while flowing, while they are still in equilibrium. And this allows us to define a rate of entropy production, although typically in an out of equilibrium there is no entropy. But we can define the rate as a 1 over T1. Here I'm allowing the systems even to be at different temperatures, the two leads. So I have 1 over T1 delta Q1 dt and the sum, which becomes this expression, 1 over T1 minus 1 over T2 times the energy current, and mu1 over T1 minus mu2 over T2 times the particle or the charge current. And since we calculated the currents, we can calculate the entropy production. A question that we are very curious about is whether this definition, and this is a conjecture, whether this definition that I've given, the thermodynamic definition, has a counterpart, a Boltzmannian definition via entanglement. In other words, if I call rho S rho 1, 2, the full rho, and I reduce it, in other words, I define rho 1 as I'm tracing over 2, this no longer commutes with the Hamiltonian. And similarly, if I reduce rho, integrating out all the degrees of freedom in system 1, I get rho 2, which no longer commutes with the Hamiltonian, although rho S does. And then sigma, morally, we hope, is going to be given by this expression. But this is not yet a full calculation.
So you hope to be able to use your earlier formula to prove this.
I'm not sure that it's true, but this is a hypothesis, and this is kind of an open question. There are other questions that one can ask. Onsager relation out of equilibrium, one gets very interesting thermoelectric. You can build a quantum dot refrigerator where you have you pump heat via voltage difference, etc., etc.
But probably since it's only a dot.
You cannot. I'm not going to sell refrigerators this way. An interesting thing is how to compute the effects of a strong correlation on entropy production. In other words, As we know, when we study the system on a different energy scale, the physics changes. And for example, we can compare results of the full condo. This is actually, for the full condo, we know only this part and this part. So don't take it too much in detail.
So why do we know that we do a perturbation theory of sigma using, well, just the formulas you wrote down.
Yeah.
And then you get
this. So you, at very large voltage, you can do perturbation theory. Here you assume, you know, and you can compare it to what happens at the strong coupling fixed point, which is described by this model, and you see that the strong correlation enhances entropy production. I've not heard anybody measuring entropy in this context, but it would be a very amusing experiment to do. One has to do the spectroscopy of electrons that come out, and then one can measure entropy.
Well, I guess one could think about the entanglement entropy of the electrons that come out and leak one and leak.
I don't know if people have measured that, but that we can calculate that.
There have been proposals for doing things like
calculate that. Measurements. Okay, that's very exciting.
Proposals.
Yeah. Okay, I think conclusion. So I showed scattering, I computed, blah, blah, blah. Okay, many other things to do. So I did mainly T equals to zero. One can do finite temperature, different temperatures, calculation of thermal currents, spin currents. One can do it for more leads, and using some nice work of Lebanon and Schiller, one can obtain the non-equilibrium density of states from studying more leads, using one lead as an STM over the current going through the others. One can do something which I've not touched on, a real scattering problem, calculate exclusive, inclusive scattering amplitudes, get explicit expression that enter into Boltzmann equations that describe experiments, for example, in the French group at Saclay, they precisely measured these scattering cross sections. There are many other ambitious things to do. For example, can one do a real, honest, non-equilibrium RG, I mean a non-perturbative one, or how to give a non-equilibrium description of bulk systems, or what I would find is the most exciting question is there some principle, let's say even for steady state, that replaces the Boltzmann principle so that we can write rho s directly? In other words, in equilibrium we can write rho is equal e minus beta h. Is there something similar out of equilibrium? Probably not, but at least we can we have a very precise handle on it.
Well, the trouble with this might be that one obtains an expression is only valid for integrable systems.
But no. But you have to extract from general principles. There is a big jump, and then you have, but at least you can check it precisely in some context. Okay, thank you.
I guess under the scattering problems, the exciting aspect is if you do a scattering problem, it's always an impurity problem, right?
By definition, scattering is an impurity problem.
So
this is a general.
All of this only works because of the impurity aspect.
Exactly.
In an obvious way, modulo your last finding.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question. I seem to remember theorems, general scattering theorems, that say that if the difference between the original Hamiltonian plus the perturbation, which is just the perturbation, is trace class, then there is always
trace class
scattering operator. So there is a steady state. Did you think about it in these terms?
You mean molar operators and all of them?
No, that means just the perturbation itself has eigenvalues are converging if you just sum them over.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you thought about it in this context.
No, but
in your case, in the condo, it's not a trace class operator because the operator itself just is local. The perturbation, but you have huge degeneracy from whatever happens in the leads themselves.
Exactly.
It kind of looks like it doesn't, it's not, maybe shouldn't ruin it because, I don't know, maybe you can generalize it.
Why don't you come and tell me afterwards? That would be very interesting. I'm sorry.
Maybe there is a very general statement to be said.
Okay, that would be very nice.
Two quick questions. First, I just wanted to check. So with your definition of the rate of entropy production, is it right that there would be entropy production even just from potential scattering?
I am not sure. Because you must have... Yeah, but then you need out of equilibrium.
I mean, with a finite bias.
But you do need electrons to cross from one to the other. Then yes, definitely. This has nothing to do with this. But right? I mean, if electrons one can cross to two, and they are different, this is mu one and mu two. The entropy production.
Yeah.
The entropy production is due to the fact that we lose information about these electrons.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with strong correlation. This has to do with non-equilibrium.
Okay, and then the other question was on the outgoing leads, presumably you could think about the momentum distribution of the particles.
No. This is a...
Is that something that you've calculated?
No. Yeah, I mean...
You have access to
information. Yeah, exactly. In principle, since we have explicit form of those states, we have to calculate expectation values of certain operators and... Yeah.
You know, there has been a very big activity on out-of-equilibrium statistical mechanics, out-of-equilibrium classical statistics.
Yeah.
Yes. For example, this is the solve of the models, one-dimensional model
right.
by Derrida.
Right.
Also, there is a hydrodynamic approach by the own group, and they play very similar to that. So,
similar in what sense?
Huh?
What do you, similar in what sense?
To each other or to
this? To each other. It's not mathematics. So Derrida and Lepovitz and other people have exact results.
Mm-hmm.
In the other cases, we have a kind of general approach with some assumptions like family density, areas, and that. But if they apply the models they done the time loop, they find exactly the same.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. That's what.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible to make any connection?
Well, I just was talking last week to Herbert to learn about this question precisely. This is not in scattering or impurity, but it more goes on to the bulk bulk questions. Yeah. So direct.
They really study bulk systems.
Or Galavotti, for example.
Yeah, also, I don't know, he looks at the thermostatic systems, and they are typically thermostatic in the power elements.
But perhaps, I mean, we were talking with Herbert on looking on a system, let's say, of one of those system, and sort of isolating a part, and imagining that you have here more particles hopping in, and particles hopping out, and this way creating an impurity problem. Okay, and then maybe this kind of type of formulation could be described, sort of, you go to infinity and you have a flow in and a flow out. Okay, and then you can talk about, well, P equals to half, but then it would be biased by having more coming in from here and going out. One can have fun and have Q, which tries to go against it. One can have maybe. I don't know yet. I've not thought about these questions.
Okay, in view of the time and our next talk starting at 2, we should probably wrap up this session and thank Andre once again for our talk.
Okay.